So my name's Rob, and I kind of wanted to build off of the talk that we had last week. So, just as a reminder, last week we kind of started with this quote from Iakima. I just love this quote. Where she says there's a common misperception that mindfulness reduces suffering. This is not the case. Mindfulness reduces the self that suffers. And so then we went in and we started talking a little bit about this notion of vedana, is often translated as feeling or feeling tone or hedonic tone. And so Vedana signifies this very early, you could call it appraisal. It's not a full-blown emotion. In Buddhist psychology, an emotion is much more complex than Vedana. It's actually considered a part of citta or mind. But Vedana is this very early phase in the perceptual process where we essentially make some kind of sensory contact with an object, and then that sensory contact will touch off a feeling tone, an immediate impression of that object or the situation as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And so we also talked a little bit about, how this term Vedana occupies several important positions in a variety of different early Buddhist kind of principles. So, for example, it is one of the five aggregates. It's also one of the links in the 12-link chain of dependent origination that describes, how we keep coming back to samsara and this place of suffering. And Vedana, importantly, in that dependent origination scheme, is the very thing that actually leads us headfirst into craving, which is the precise cause of suffering as articulated in the Four Noble Truths. The one other thing that I kind of wanted to just bring back up is this notion that that our tendency to feel pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral stimuli on the part of sense contact is a natural process. It's a human process. It's a you could even say it's an animal process in many ways. But this tendency for that state of unpleasantness or pleasantness or indifference or not caring to lead us into clinging or trying to get more of what we want or to push away what we don't want or to not care, right? That process itself is not something that we are independently culpable of. It's an impersonal process that happens to us when we don't pay attention. So we usually like to think that I want this or I like this. But when we see that the tendency for Vedana to turn into clinging is an impersonal process that's conditioned, right? We kind of flip that argument around, and rather than us wanting, right, it is this Vedana that leads us headfirst into wanting. And that's the very thing that kind of creates or instigates the illusion of having some kind of separate personal identity. So it's the self that's really being constructed through this clinging process. Now, in addition, feeling tone or Vedana is also occupies a position in the Satipatthana, or Four Foundations of Mindfulness scheme, where Vedana is the second Satipatthana. So today what I'd like to do is kind of go into a little bit about another term, which is called citta. And this is commonly, citta is spelled C-I-T-T-A. It's pronounced citta. And it's commonly translated as mind or mental state. And so citta occupies a variety of important positions in the Buddhist kind of scheme. Importantly, it is the third foundation or establishment of mindfulness that's described in the Satipatthana Sutta. So before we go into the nature of citta, I just want to kind of provide a very general summary or overview of what Satipatthana is, so I'm not, for those who are less familiar, so it might make a little more sense. So the Satipatthana Sutta is widely regarded as one of the most important documents in Buddhist literature, right? It is commonly translated as the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four establishments of mindfulness. You could say that it's the four things that would be beneficial if you applied your mindfulness to them, right? And so the first one in this Satipatthana scheme is mindfulness of the body. And so mindfulness of the body involves a sequence of three different contemplations that on the whole are an attempt to help people disidentify with or become less attached to their physical body. And so those exercises are, one of them is called meditation on the foulness of the body. Some people would say it's an examination of the anatomical parts of the body, where you're looking at the body in terms of its various organs, and it may become apparent to you that typically our run-of-the-mill way of understanding our body is like we identify with things like the skin on our face, but we don't identify so much with our spleen, right? The second exercise in the mindfulness of the body contemplation is called the four elements contemplation, where we examine how this body is the sense of solidity or temperature or the liquids or the gases that comprise this body are not different from the liquids and solids and the nature of temperature that's found outside of the body. And so this body is, you know, in one way, it is not separate from nature, but as a consequence, you don't really have, like, this body isn't a stable sense or a foundation for some personal sense of identity, right? So it's a way of essentially kind of approaching this idea of anatta or not self. And then the third contemplation on the body involves comparing our physical body to that of a decaying corpse and acknowledging that this body is not exempt from that fate and that it too will die and it too will decay. So if that's not heavy enough, right? But I mean, that's a pretty heavy introduction to Satipatthana body contemplation. And after that is the contemplation on feeling tone or Vedana, which we talked about last week, where we're examining this early appraisal of some kind of sensory stimulus as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And it's that sense of pleasantness, unpleasantness, or indifference that we may have that lead us to crave and ultimately to suffer. So the third foundation in the Satipatthana scheme is mindfulness of the mind, or mindfulness of mental states, or citta. And this is where it's kind of it naturally flows from the contemplation on feeling tone, in that now what we're examining is the presence or the absence of three fetters, right? Of this tendency to want or to desire things, the tendency to have aversion or to not like things, and the tendency towards delusion, or, you know, not really caring, or just kind of running in circles. And so Satipatthana kind of takes on an overarching theme, in that it begins with very graphic content and progresses into more and more subtle objects of mindfulness. And so, just to lay it out, in the Satipatthana, the key kind of cue about how to practice this is stated as such. The Buddha says, one knows mind with wanting and knows mind without wanting. One knows mind with aversion and knows mind without aversion. One knows mind with delusion and knows mind without delusion. Now, it also, depending on what tradition, if it's from Chinese or from the Pali, other elements are also included in this contemplation. For example, looking for contracted mind or distracted mind or worldly mind or unworldly mind. But I'm going to try to, kind of stray away from those and just focus on these, three fetters in tonight's talk. So whenever one is practicing in this domain of mindfulness of the mind, implicit in this exercise is a shift in emphasis away from our ordinary mode of experiencing the mind, in which we tend to filter things and appraise things on the basis of what they mean for the self, right? We look at things in terms of our liking, our disliking, or our not caring. And when we're practicing mindfulness in this domain, there's a shift such that we're attempting to consider the events that occur in the mind as impersonal, where we're trying to put on full display these processes and things that happen to us, thoughts and emotions, different levels of, different types of mental states. We're trying to see them and see the causes of them, right? And particularly see Vedana as one of the causes of them. And one of the things that may occur, and I think this may be an early insight that many people have when they first start practicing, is this tendency to notice that we have much less control over the contents of our mind than we think. And so by taking an impersonal perspective on the contents in our mind, we can see that much of the time, these very thoughts and feelings that previously we had said are I or mine are actually just at the whim of external circumstances and conditions. And so social psychology is just full of demonstrations of this. So for example, I teach a statistics class. And one example that I do in class is I'll have half of the students go into a different room and the other half stay in the original classroom. And I'll ask them to write down 10 things that they need to get done before the end of the day tomorrow. And so they'll sit there and they'll make their lists. And then they come back together and we compare the number of cleaning related items that they have in their list. And inevitably, one group always has significantly more cleaning related items. And they don't know this, but the reason is because before class, I went into the room and wiped the desk down with Lysol or with Pine Sol. And so the Pine Sol essentially will prime them to think of cleaning related items. And quite naturally, the question comes up, did I think that thought or did that thought happen to me as dictated by some kind of external condition? So another example of this would be, you know, how the certain emotions bias our attitudes. So for example, if you prime people and put them in a state of disgust, where they feel disgusted at something. Well, disgust is an emotion that tends to foster prejudice. And so when you make a person in a state of disgust, they're gonna completely change their thinking about outgroup members. And this has been demonstrated over and over and over. And so we love to give ourselves credit that we think our own thoughts and feel our own feelings and that they're ours, but the evidence from nearly a century of social psychology indicate that that is hardly the case. And so by practicing, kind of coming back into this, you know, four foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the mind, in practicing in this domain, it becomes possible for us to observe the very subtle, pleasant and unpleasant and neutral vedana that give rise to these downstream states of wanting, aversion, and delusion, right? We can see the conditions that lead to our mind being in a certain state. And so in this third Satipatthana, the goal isn't necessarily to take some kind of active step to remove those fetters or to oppose any unwholesome state like that's related to craving, like wanting or aversion. But it's to maintain an open and receptive awareness to that state of mind and learn what are the conditions that give rise to it and that give rise to its absence. So, I mean, oftentimes we are professionals at self-deception. Right. Sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's unconscious, but we all have this bias to want to see ourselves in a positive light. We want to have see ourselves as a positive object of esteem. And most of the time, we're less concerned with having an honest appraisal of how we really are. But this exercise in this third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the mind, aims directly at that and helping us try to honestly acknowledge many of the hidden motives and emotions and tendencies that we have in the mind without immediately squashing them and suppressing them because they have some kind of unpleasant implication for the self. And so social psychology, again, has so much literature on these different types of self-protective and self-enhancing biases. So I'll give you one example, right? So there's the correspondence bias, where it's also called the fundamental attribution error, where, you know, if you're driving down the road and someone cuts in front of you into your lane, you're most likely going to attribute their behavior to them as a person, to their personality. You might call them an asshole, you know, or something like this. However, if it was you doing it, you would give yourself the benefit of the doubt, right? Where you're not an asshole when you cut in front of people. You're just in a hurry, right? It's a situational factor for you, but it's something about their personality. And so this is one of those biases that really helps protect and enhance our own sense of esteem and self-worth at the expense of having an honest perspective of the way things really are. So another example of this is the self-serving bias, which the self-serving bias is essentially the correspondence bias just turned on to the self. So for example, if you had students in a classroom taking a test, when they do good, they take personal credit for their success. It's because they're really smart, because, you know, they're just naturally good at it. However, if they fail the test, of course, it's always the fault of the professor, or that the test was too hard, or something like this. And so they tend to blame failure on external circumstances and take credit for personal success. And so this bias is another example of how we often unconsciously distort information in ways that best serves the self rather than trying to see things honestly. Another example would be something like mnemic neglect, which is kind of a mouthful. But so this construct of mnemic neglect represents a self-protective memory error where people selectively forget negative things about the self, but remember positive things. So if I, you know, ask you a bunch of, you know, tell you a bunch of things about yourself after you take a personality inventory, you're more likely going to remember the positive things and you will forget the negative things. And quite a bit of research has been done on this, demonstrating that, you know, across cultures, this occurs. And so that makes it so that you're only retrieving positive things about yourself, not a balanced view of how you really are. So I brought up these three examples because recent literature within the last 5 years has demonstrated that mindfulness is a very powerful force at reducing these biases, at allowing people to recognize these biases and to act in ways that oppose them so that they can have a more honest perspective of the present moment. And so goal of this practice in the domain of citta or mindfulness of the mind is to try to elicit a very balanced, impersonal perspective where we're able to watch our own mental activity and get a firsthand perspective on the biases that are constantly acting on us and distorting our worldview. And so basically, you know, just a reminder, the exercise, the instructions for this exercise are simply to know whenever the mind is wanting and know whenever the mind is not wanting, to know whenever the mind is in a state of aversion, and to know whenever that state of aversion is absent, and to know whenever we're in a state of delusion, or know whenever that state of delusion is absent. Now, maybe a shorthand here, a lot of people describe this as know when the mind is pulling in, wanting, pulling in something, know whenever the mind is trying to push something away, get rid of something that's aversive, or just kind of running in circles when the mind just either doesn't care or is just deluded and rolling around in some daydream, right? And so we're aiming here to see what happens within the mind when it is in one of these states, wanting, aversion, or delusion. And so the flip side is noticing their absence. And so it may be easy at first to tend towards noticing the wanting, noticing the aversion, noticing the delusion. However, eventually, there will come a point when we examine the mind and we see that these qualities aren't present. And these fetters aren't in the mind. And when we notice that, we may notice that there's a subtle joy when the mind isn't afflicted by them. And technically, a mind that is existing without wanting, without aversion, without delusion, is the mind arahant, which is essentially an enlightened person, right? This state without these defilements is a glimpse of enlightenment right now. And so in this way, by looking at the presence and the absence of these different states of craving, the contemplation of the mind allows one to survey your own development meditation, because we can see things from a very wide range, from the being in the thick of wanting and aversion and delusion, to very sublime and simple states that are calm and tranquil whenever those states are absent. Importantly, this perspective that we're taking is one of an impersonal nature. We see these things as happening to us, not ours. And so this, again, kind of speaks to this Ayakema quote that we started out with, that there's this common misperception that mindfulness reduces suffering. This is not true. Mindfulness reduces the self that suffers. And I feel like last week, we kind of dug into that quote through the perspective of Vedana. And if I did any justice to the topic, I was hoping to kind of apply that same perspective through the lens of working with mindfulness of the mind today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.